Welcome to Just a Minute.
My life is more than just a minute, because if you must count them, over 48 million minutes have passed since I was born. And together, those minutes add up to 92 years. 92 years of acting, presenting, and creating laughter. But I have a secret passion. And I suppose you could say it's about time.
12 o'clock, you'll get 12 chimes.
Or more precisely, clocks.
At home with Nicholas.
I adore clocks and watches. Every hour, my house echoes to the chimes of antique clocks, big and small.
Big Ben, eat your heart out. 1655. And still going strong, in perfect condition.
But there's one watch, made by one watchmaker, that I'm desperate to hold in my hand. Many consider it the greatest watch ever made. It was conceived for a queen who ran out of time, by the greatest watchmaker the world has ever known. A watch begun in the 1780s, sold in the 1880s, stolen in the 1980s, it is the most valuable timepiece in the whole world.
I wouldn't expect it to go for less than 50 to 100 million.
It's called the Marie Antoinette, and it's a watch that I would travel to the other side of the world just to gaze upon its face. I may be in my 90s, but there's still time for another great adventure.
The incredible story of Marie Antoinette's watch with Nicholas Parsons. Shelves housing Nicholas's collection of timepieces and silver, along with family photographs. In the living room, he's setting up an antique pendulum clock.
Okay, his suspension springs are so delicately poised.
My passion for clocks began in the 1930s.
Right. It's on.
I'd always been interested in mechanical things, and when I was 15, my father was offered an unwanted collection of old clock parts and pieces.
He said, well, we've got an attic, ship them up to the house, and I'll get somebody in who understands about clocks to give my son a little bit of tuition. And in that particular crate was this little chap here. And I've had the clock ever since. That would be 1938.
Those lessons from that kindly clockmaker fired up a lifelong love of clocks and clockwork.
Listen to this. Isn't that charming? I can do this. I'll have to set it again. It is the craftsmanship that has designed all that so that one wheel interconnects with the other and moves that one on. And then the ratchet was lifted on the hour, boom, and it strikes. That to me is poetry in motion.
I always wanted to be an actor. My parents were having none of it. Having spotted my talent with clocks, they sent me off to be an engineer. In 1940, I travelled from the secure home in North London to the rough streets of Glasgow to begin an engineering apprenticeship on Clydebank. It was noisy, it was difficult, it was demanding, it was tough, building pumps as well as serving in the firm's home guard. I was only 16 years of age. In many ways, it was the making of me. At the end of my apprenticeship, I returned to London. The war was almost over, and I chose to pursue my first love, the theatre. I've had a long career in show business. For many years, I was a character actor.
Mrs. Villiers, I will not waste your time.
14 years of Sale of the Century, as well as many guest appearances in films and elsewhere. and for nearly 50 years, I've been presenting Just a Minute.
I would suggest they chose another...
Poor challenge.
Deviation.
Why?
Well, it doesn't
In fact,
mean...
I'm still hosting that show to this day. But once an engineer, always an engineer. And I've never stopped working with my hands, but in my own time.
I can't take it too high, because it doesn't like it.
Collecting clocks, mending clocks, tending clocks.
What I do find very frustrating is because I am mechanically very mature, and I've always been able to use my hands, make things, create things, repair things, and I see that as part of the natural creativity of my nature. I know why it's ticking. I know what's going on behind. I know the expertise and skills, putting all those wheels together. The clock's working. It's talking to me, telling me the time. And I give it attention. I pull its chain up every night.
Nicholas is about to board a train.
But now it's time to go in search of the greatest clockmaker of all time and his masterpiece, the legendary Marie Antoinette watch, the most precious piece of clockwork in the whole world. So, I'm on the Eurostar, time-travelling to 18th century Paris, where his story and the tale of this legendary timepiece begins.
This is a real adventure. And for someone who grew up with steam trains, to be on Eurostar, going to Paris, that romantic city. What better if you're going to Paris, the land that created champagne? The expedition begins here. Cheers.
The train travelling through the countryside.
As a member of the Worshipful Company of Clockmakers, I should confess that the great English clockmakers of the past would not have approved of my unpatriotic direction of travel, because for centuries it was England that was to the fore in clockmaking. In the 17th century, Thomas Tompion, the father of English clockmaking, invented a clock that could run for a year on a single wind. In the 1760s, English reputations soared when a brilliant Yorkshireman called John Harrison invented a series of clocks and chronometers that solved the life and death riddle of navigating via longitude. English horology was something to be proud of.
Nicholas disembarking in Paris.
In fact, English travellers used to bring watches with them and sell them on to appreciative Parisians.
A view across the city to the Eiffel Tower.
Back in the 1750s, one French publication lamented that even a coach driver wouldn't be seen without a watch unless it was made in England.
I was trying to work out the last time I was in Paris, and it's amazing. It must have been late 40s or certainly early 50s. And my goodness, the changes.
In the latter half of the 18th century, Paris was enthralled by the Enlightenment. The rulers saw this new era of invention as something that would empower France. And the scientists and engineers dared to believe that reason may triumph over religion. Mastery of clockwork appealed to everyone.
You've got two things going on in France during the 17th and 18th century. One is la grande nation, the idea of the great nation, in which gloire, glory, is the French court enacting the destiny of God. And at the same time, you've got what you might call les lumières, the enlightenment, which is about science, technology, rationality, with something like a watch. You've got the two coming together. You've got, you know, the poetic idea of France enacting the destiny of God by making new technology. But you've got technology, which is the product of reason, rationality. And I think time is really important because mathematics is really important. This is the law of the universe. So by carrying a little fob watch around, you're actually carrying around the laws of the universe.
Clockwork isn't just about clocks. It's a descriptive phrase for anything mechanical, like this tympanum player here, which was designed by two
German designers, actually, in 1784, and was presented as a gift to Marie Antoinette at the court. That is clockwork par excellence. Clockwork embodied the very principles of the Enlightenment. Who needs religion and magic when intricate engineering and clever construction can combine to give life to the inanimate? Clockmakers were mechanical magicians.
The automaton of Marie Antoinette playing the dulcimer, a glimpse of the inner mechanics turning. Dressed in her finery, Marie strikes the strings with hammers held in each hand. The automaton's head turns to mimic human movement.
But faced with the brilliance of German automata and a century of English engineering dominance, the French were ready for a master of the mechanical arts they could claim as their own. Cometh the hour, cometh the man. Or as the French say,
cometh le, cometh l'homme. In 1775, the 28-year-old Abraham Louis Breguet arrived here in the Quai de l'Horloge, which was then the clock-making heart of Paris. And single-handedly, his genius transformed this part of the city into the watchmaking capital of the world.
Breguet is rightly regarded as a genius. I think that's the first word that comes to everyone's mind when his name is mentioned.
Breguet was a main person in terms of producing watches and clocks and always looking for improvements in his production. So he was very important for France.
To position him for someone who doesn't know anything about the history of watchmaking, his life is the watershed. Everything that went before was refined by him. Before he had reached 45, he had achieved the title of probably the greatest watchmaker alive then, and he's still regarded as that by many.
So who was this incredible engineer, this conjurer in clockwork? Like so many of the great watchmakers, Abraham Louis Breguet was in fact Swiss. He was born in 1747 in Neuchâtel. His father died when he was 11, and his mother remarried his father's cousin, who was a watchmaker. He took young Abraham out of school and made him an apprentice. In the first year of his apprenticeship, young Abraham Louis Breguet learned all about the basics of horology. As he was put to work to polish the movements, the gears, the balance wheels, the pinions, the escapement, he learned about clocks, chronometers, and watches. How to make tick follow tock.
A clock face.
After serving just a year of his apprenticeship in Geneva, he had learned all he could and was dispatched to Paris to work with more experienced and sophisticated watchmakers. He wanted to learn the ingenious ways they created smaller pieces which had greater accuracy. He was eager to understand what's known in the horological world as complications. That is, any watch feature that is an addition to telling the basic hours and minutes, such as chimes, moon phases, dates. Complications require a deeper clockwork knowledge and a deeper understanding of time itself. So Breguet came to the Collège des Quatre Nations, where he learned of solar cycles, lunar calendars, and choreographing chronology. He also fell in love, got married, and with the help from his wife, finally set up his own premises here in the appropriately named Quai de l'Horloge.
The literal translation of that is clock dock. Now, you would have thought the Parisians, the French, with their love of the romantic, would at least have called this place Rue de l'Horloge, Street of the Clock.
And the first amazing invention to emerge from this little shop was Breguet's perpetuel watch. As it sounds, a perpetuel was a watch that didn't need daily winding. Through clever clockwork, it wound itself, harnessing the energy in the motion of the wearer. It was the must-have gadget of the 1780s. But this was just the beginning. Breguet's shop became the center of watchmaking innovations and inventions.
Breguet changed everything in the mechanism, in the techniques, and in the aesthetic field.
He worked on moon phase. He invented the gong for the minute repeater, so that chiming watches today are much more musical than they were prior to Breguet's appearance when gongs were used. There's pretty much nothing that he didn't refine.
And he was quite interesting in going always a step further into inventing new things, new functions, new items, and always keeping this into a very simple and elegant look.
To this day, Breguet's name still lives on in some of the most exclusive shopping streets in the world. Rodeo Drive, Bond Street, and here at the Place Vendôme in Paris. The brand is now owned by the Swatch Group, and the Breguet Boutique in Paris is home to a wondrous collection of his original work.
Once Stradivarius was to violins, Breguet was to watches. He had this unique talent to make time sing, and he did that so sweetly.
At last, I'm getting to see for myself some of Breguet's exceptional work. The first thing that strikes you is the design.
Such gems of beauty.
These watches are beautiful, but minimal. They possess that increasingly rare quality of elegance.
And they're all catalogued here, beautifully.
Breguet's watches had their own fonts, long before the idea of a font. The dials of his watches were often engraved with intricate, textured, guilloché patterns. And the hands are thin, with little poppy-type bud, tipped to a precision point. So, it's a rare privilege to be so close to so much ticking treasure.
Well, I suppose this is one of the reasons I came to Paris, to have the joy and pleasure of actually holding a Breguet watch, designed by him with a Breguet watch. There was always a simplicity.
In fact, this is one of his most minimal watches. It's from 1798, and it's what was called a subscription watch, where the buyer would make a down payment and pay off the rest in installments.
There may be only one hand, but it's so designed that you can work it out with the halves and the quarters, even the minutes. But it has some distinctive Breguet innovations here, the poppy handle. And that's usual on nearly all watches now.
The Breguet style is a combination between simplicity and utility. It's a very sober, and it appears sober, even if it's very complicated. And it is a chic of Breguet.
It's wonderful to hold it. It's like you can really feel the heartbeat of this beautiful piece of mechanism.
The only thing that's excessive is the price. These simple watches are highly valued collector's items now. Earlier this year, one of Breguet's original pocket watches sold for over $3 million. But then, from the very beginning, Breguet's watches were luxuries. Luxuries that required rich patrons with deep pockets. Fortunately for Breguet's newly established business, 16 miles away from the clock dock shop was a concentration of wealth, of vanity, of peacocking like nowhere else in the world.
Gardens and fountains leading to a magnificent palace, the sparkling interior.
Versailles.
Chandeliers hanging from the gilded ceiling in a long gallery lined with statues.
Wealth, power, influence, fashion, money, patronage were all concentrated around the palace. 2,000 acres of extravagance, with King Louis XVI on the French throne and Marie Antoinette, his notoriously decadent queen, by his side. And one of the more restrained parts of the palace is here at the Petit Trianon. This was a bolt hole that was gifted to the Queen, Marie Antoinette. If she'd had enough of the golden palace, the masked balls, or the fine wine, she could retreat down here. Though it's hardly a hovel.
Nicholas enters a period drawing room.
Versailles was packed with aristocrats and archdukes trying to outdo one another. So how could a courtier compete? It was a great advantage socially to have a talking point. And what better for this purpose than a watch? And when that watch was exceptional, well, then the French would say it was très à la mode. And owning a Breguet became the height of good taste.
It was a closed circle of the very wealthy people, and so if one held a Breguet watch, then others knew. So it was spreading inside the sort of rich community.
So this was your iPhone 6 of the 18th century, and it did stuff that nothing else can do. And that was the thing about a watch. It wasn't just jewellery. It was jewellery that did stuff. And a bit like today, with people sort of constantly looking at their tablets and things. I've just got to have a look. Have you seen my fob watch?
Producing a slim, modern Breguet watch, showing the moon cycle or the calendar, allowed a courtier to exhibit their wealth, taste, and modernity. Breguet was held in high regard in the highest circles at the palace, and it resulted in the most important commission of his life, when he was instructed to create a watch for the Queen of Versailles, the Queen of France, Marie Antoinette.
A portrait of Marie holding a rose, a man turning the key in one lock, then another.
Locked away in a secure vault are the original ledgers from Breguet's workshop that record this amazing commission. Emmanuel Breguet, the great-great-great-great-great-grandson of Abraham Louis Breguet, is showing them to me.
It is a very interesting piece of archives. It's a register with all the details about the construction of the antique Breguet watches.
So Breguet kept a record of every single watch or clock he sold.
On each page, you have the details about five watches. You have the names, the name of the watchmakers who worked on this specific watch, and you have the name of the buyer, of the client. Mm-hmm. You have the date of the sale, and you have the price. And an interesting page is the page about the watch 160, because the watch 160 is called Marie Antoinette watch.
And
yes. And you have an idea of the work.
Breguet's 160th commission, to make a watch fit for La Reine. In front of me is the original record of all the years of work that went into that watch and that became known as the Marie Antoinette. The details are extraordinary. While most entries are a couple of lines, this commission covers a page and a half, and they had to insert an extra leaf just to record all the complexities. The watch was to be a lady's watch that would chime the hours, the quarter hours. It should have a thermometer. It was to display day, date, month, years, and even leap years. It should tell solar time. It should be delicate, but robust. Every bearing and roller, without exception, would be in sapphire. The watch would be the culmination of every complexity Breguet knew. A stunning horological tour de force that was to be as beautiful as it was ingenious. The commission specifically stipulated all the complications possible and known be incorporated in it. Everywhere, gold must completely replace brass. No limit on time of manufacture or on price.
What was very special is the order was to do the maximum of complications possible, the most beautiful materials possible, and probably something very dangerous, no limitation of time. And never say something like that to a watchmaker. It's absolutely a catastrophe.
Bringing all the complications existing at the time into one watch was some sort of a challenge for him that he wanted to work on. It was a sort of summary of all which could be done and showing that Breguet can do each and everything that goes into this very many complications.
So, who was this mysterious commissioner granting Breguet limitless time and limitless amounts of money?
We don't know the name of the commissioner, unfortunately.
It's one of the many mysteries that surrounds the watch. And over the years, there has been much speculation. Legend has it that the story of the greatest watch ever made began with a certain tall, handsome Swedish character. Someone who might be described as a dishy devil. Count Hans Axel von Fersen, a Swedish nobleman, who during his grand tour of Europe stopped off here in Versailles and apparently created quite a stir. Fersen met Marie Antoinette at a masked ball. The Swedish count and the French queen became very close friends. Very close. It is one of the big mysteries of French history, whether, as was suspected, they became lovers. And it was at this same historical moment that somebody placed that very special order for the queen. Whoever it was, the challenge clearly inspired Breguet, because that order for that watch was to be the culmination of Breguet's life's work. It would take 44 years to finish. The Queen of Versailles would never see it, and the mysterious commissioner would never pay for it. Even Breguet would die before his masterpiece could be completed. But the watch that became known as the Marie Antoinette would be the greatest watch that the world has ever seen.
The intricate working cogs of a watch, a clock face with a sun decoration.
At the beginning of the 1780s, France teetered on the brink of seismic change. But for Breguet, business was booming. He was acclaimed by rich patrons. He became a French citizen and was inducted as a master of the Clockmaker's Guild. High in his workshop in the Quai de l'Horloge, Breguet worked assiduously, experimenting, engineering, of course, creating. His clockwork creations were horology at its most harmonious and, for the time, very little friction. French society, however, was strained and fractured. The crops had failed, the people starved. Conditions were abysmal. And there were whisperings against the frivolities at Versailles. The subjects were revolting.
Professor Andrew Hussey.
She never underestimates the divisions in French society in the years, the decades leading up to the French Revolution. If you like, Paris and Versailles were like two countries, two cities at war. They weren't the same place at all. In Versailles, you've got what I would call the society of the spectacle, which is actually a very 20th century idea. But really, you can see it's all about performance, it's all about show, and all in the name of the great destiny of France. The real life of the French in Paris is all about disease, debt, poverty. People are dying of hunger while the rich are spending their money on parties, fêtes galantes, and, you know, this whole spectacular world that they've created.
Marie Antoinette. Of course, rumour has it that she made that famous remark when told that her subjects were starving and they hadn't got enough bread. And she said, well, let them eat cake. I think it's really apocryphal. But it did give an indication of what was going on at the time.
And the hungry people realized that feudal France wasn't working.
Clockwork is a very seductive metaphor. When things in life go smoothly, we say they're running like clockwork. If only life could be so predictable, so logical, so harmonious. But alas, it never is.
A clock tower sculpture.
In July 1789, with bread prices at an all-time high, an angry and hungry crowd stormed the Bastille fortress and paraded the governor's head on a pike around the streets of Paris. What would become known as the French Revolution had begun. On the national and international level, the revolution was seismic. On a personal level, events were calamitous for Breguet's business. The mysterious commission without a limit on price and destined for the Queen would have to wait. Because his wealthy and aristocratic customers had a habit of losing their heads.
The aristocrats who could afford it fled abroad. The unlucky ones faced Madame la Guillotine. C'est bon. Merci beaucoup.
Nicholas sniffs a cork.
Breguet was a supporter of the revolution, but the mutinous streets of his beloved Paris were becoming ever bloodier. And anyone who was even suspected of harboring sympathy for the hated royals, and in particular Marie Antoinette, was in real danger.
People were being killed left, right and center. And whatever your political connections, and you know, Breguet was connected to the court because he sold them stuff, your life was in danger. And the French historian Jules Michelet, I think he gives a good sort of illustration of just how gory that period was. He describes, I think it's about sort of 20 or 30 years afterwards, the executions on Place de la Concorde, that animals couldn't cross the bridge at Place de la Concorde because they could smell the blood. And if you pressed down on a pavé, blood would come to the surface. And we've often got the Blue Peter version of the French Revolution. It was a gory, bloody, terrible period, and severed heads were everywhere.
In 1793, when the terror was at its height, Breguet feared for his life. So he fled Paris and took refuge in his native Switzerland, taking the Marie Antoinette, still under construction, with him. The watch was safe, but the Queen herself was not so lucky. Now hated by the French people, she was brought by a cart to the Place de la Révolution. It is said she had a small, simple steel Breguet watch pinned to her gown, counting down her final hours, minutes, and seconds. And at 12:15, on the 16th of October, 1793, with the crowds booing her final minutes, the guillotine blade sliced through Marie Antoinette's neck. The world kept turning. The clocks kept ticking. And France began a new era.
Carved stone reads, Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité.
There was a new anthem, a new flag, and a new ethos. France would show the rest of the world its revolutionary new ways of thinking. So they decreed that measurements were to be decimalized. That meant liters, meters, and a radical new 10-hour clock.
But when you think about it, there's some logic in that. A day should be 10 hours, an hour should be 100 minutes, and a minute should be 100 seconds.
So the clockmakers of Paris started to build decimal clocks.
So there's a little clock, a little decimal clock. And at the bottom, it actually shows the 10 hours.
But though the newfangled decimal time was logical, ordinary people brought up in the traditional system were confounded by it.
I mean, today, can you imagine trying to think in terms of decimalized clock? No. It's too firmly established in our way of thinking and our psyche.
Some of the post-revolutionary watches tried to show both the old and the new time.
The decimalized system on this side, going up to the 10-hour clock, and the other side, today's system, going up to the 12-hour clock.
But fortunately for Breguet and his embryonic masterpiece, decimalization never caught on. After just 70 months, that is, traditional months, the French Republic reverted back to the old measurements. After 2 years in exile, Breguet returned to Paris in 1795, overflowing with ideas and innovations.
It seems that Breguet was a true artist, not motivated by money or profit, but by perfection itself.
And perfect he did. The revolutionary era was when Breguet came of age as a watchmaker, inventing such horological wonders as an overcoil balance spring in 1795. In 1798, he created a new escapement which had so little friction that it didn't require lubrication. All incredible innovations that advanced the art of watchmaking. And it was in 1806, at an exhibition in Paris, Breguet revealed his greatest innovation to the world, the tourbillon.
Emmanuel Breguet.
Just one turn. It is a tourbillon. It's a special device invented by Breguet and patented in 1801. Special device to avoid the effects of the Earth's gravity.
Gravity meant some internal components wore out quicker than others. Breguet solved this by constantly rotating the internal workings of the watch itself, thus minimizing wear and tear.
With all the small parts in a cage, the cage does a revolution in 3 minutes.
It's a simple solution that requires complex clockwork that made watches more precise, and that is vintage Breguet.
I'm very happy to see the movement working. It's a life, it's like a human heart.
Versailles was no more, but now there was a whole new court presided over by Napoleon Bonaparte, and Breguet made watches for it. In 1810, he made a watch for Caroline Murat, the Queen of Naples. He mounted a thin watch on a little bracelet of hair and gold to be worn on the arm. It was the first wristwatch the world had ever seen, though sadly its whereabouts are now unknown. This stunning tacked watch, the idea being that you could touch the watch in your pocket and tell the time, was made for Napoleon's wife, Josephine, who was very keen that the watch should match her status.
When she bought this watch in 1800, it was with small diamonds. and when she became empress, she ordered bigger diamonds.
Breguet was the most famous watchmaker in the world. He was appointed horologist to the French Navy. He was inducted into the prestigious Academy of Science. He was presented with France's highest accolade, the Légion d'Honneur. No other watchmaker in the world came close. But all the acclaim did not distract him from his obsession. The sum of everything Breguet ever learned was channeled into a watch which became his lifetime's work, his masterpiece. As an old man, he began to work on the watch with renewed intensity. From 1812 to 1814, he worked on little else. Nobody knew better than Breguet that time on this planet was finite and precious. And his wondrous watch was so close to completion. But no matter how beautifully Breguet's clockwork creations measured the passing minutes, hours, days, years, not even he can control time itself.
A portrait of an elderly Breguet. Nicholas is walking in a cemetery.
And on September 17th, 1823, time ran out for Abraham Louis Breguet.
He wanders past headstones and tombs, a striking figure of a woman with her hand to her face.
So I've come to the extraordinary Père Lachaise graveyard in the centre of Paris, where alongside Chopin, Oscar Wilde, and a popular singer called Jim Morrison, Breguet lies buried.
The family's mausoleum.
The greatest watchmaker in Paris lived to the age of 76 years of age. Now, 76 was a pretty good age to achieve in those days. But unfortunately, the records of the period are pretty scant, so we don't know very much about the man and what he was like. I like to think that he was very much like his watches, reliable, precise, unshowy, but underneath beat a very warm and genuine heart. Breguet was, above all, a magical engineer with the ability, the talent, to harness all the vagaries and challenges represented by time. What an impressive tombstone. And with his statue at the top. The only thing is, I think the hydrangea in front were probably put there on the day he died.
The dried-out, sun-bleached flowers. Nicholas smiles, then walks away. Now he's taking in the panorama of the beautiful city.
The master was dead, but his lifetime's work had yet to come to life. The watch Breguet had been perfecting for over four decades was finally finished by his son, as the New Year fireworks filled the sky on the last day of 1827, 4 years after his father's death.
A fabulous fireworks display, a watch movement.
It was the most complicated, sophisticated, and beautiful watch in the whole world. 44 years of work. The labor time alone would amount to 17,000 gold francs. Intriguingly, the first recorded owner was an associate of the late queen, the elderly Marquis de la Grasse, who had been Marie Antoinette's page boy in his youth. When the Marquis died in 1838, the watch happened to be in the workshop for repair, and the Breguet family became its custodians once more. Keeping it under lock and key, the watch began to slip into obscurity. Not until the late 19th century did it emerge onto the market again. Finally sold by the Breguet family, it discreetly traded through the hands of various watch collectors. Then, in 1917, the Marie Antoinette was gleefully purchased by a British industrialist and passionate collector called Sir David Sanamons. Astonished by Breguet's work, Salomon's proclaimed, to carry a fine Breguet watch is to feel that you have the brains of a genius in your pocket. Salomon's idolized Breguet. He bought more than 100 of his watches, and in the 1920s published a book that catalogued his collection, including the first known photographs of the Marie Antoinette. He bequeathed the watch collection to his daughter, who then donated everything to the Museum of Islamic Art in Israel, which opened in 1974. And that was the unlikely final resting place of the Marie Antoinette watch. It stayed in its glass case, silent, and outside the world of watch enthusiasts, rarely mentioned. Until 1983, when the world's greatest watch was stolen in the world's greatest watch heist.
A historic city, a dramatic reconstruction of the crime.
On April 15th, 1983, a small car rolled through the leafy suburbs of Jerusalem. Around midnight, it quietly pulled into a lane behind the Museum of Islamic Arts.
The car's headlights go off.
A thin man, dressed in black, got out of the car. He took a bag of tools from the boot and crept to the back of the museum.
Using a torch, he makes his way to a gate, then along a passage.
He forced his way through a narrow window. And so began the greatest watch heist in history. He cut circles into the glass cabinets, then carefully lifted out over 100 antique watches, some paintings, and a couple of books. Millions of dollars of antiquities, and amongst them was the jewel in the museum's crown, the Marie Antoinette.
There's the bit of the Pink Panther to it. The brazenness, the scale of it, and ultimately that piece being part of the cash, it's one of the most remarkable thefts of all time.
Police photos of the crime scene show the Breguet burglar, or burglars, smoked cigarettes, could squeeze through a small window, and left some tools behind, but bagged a haul worth millions and millions of dollars.
Crime scene photographs, including one of a looted display cabinet. Nicholas returning from Paris, then an aeroplane taking off.
So my Breguet pilgrimage takes me to the Holy Land, towards Jerusalem and the scene of the crime. This well-planned, exquisitely executed horological heist was the biggest robbery in the history of Israel. And it put Breguet's Marie Antoinette back on the map, even if it was missing. And the police were left puzzled and confounded. It seems apt that a thief who's a genius at what he did should steal a watch which was made by a genius at what he did.
It's the diamond in the crown, you know, the biggest diamond in the crown, but he took the whole crown. I mean, maybe he picked up the museum because of this watch, I don't know. And he did it. He succeeded. It was a perfect job. What do you want? Whoever thought that somebody will go into this museum, steal the most expensive watches in the world, not to be caught?
The police looked everywhere. They watched the airports. They asked Interpol for help. They monitored the collectors. But the Marie Antoinette fell silent. In spite of being the biggest robbery in the history of Israel, there was no trace of the stolen goods.
I knew this guy. He was the officer in the police. He went all over Europe. He went to everyone. Nobody knew who did this for years.
The watch had vanished. By 2005, all hope was gone. Nicholas Hayek, the owner of the Breguet brand, was heartbroken and announced an ambitious plan to create a replica Marie Antoinette. Using just a few photographs and details from the Breguet archive, a team of engineers tried to rebuild this astonishing piece of artistry. Over 2 years, 823 handmade components were painstakingly put together. And then, with perfect timing, just as the replica was about to be unveiled, there came a glimmer of hope that the original might still be in existence when an antique dealer called Zion Yakupov got a call in his family's shop in Tel Aviv. The caller, a lawyer, repeatedly asked him to come and value some items that she was handling on behalf of an anonymous client. Eventually, Zion went along to a warehouse and the lawyer brought out a box.
Zion says, the boxes looked old and yellowed. Everything was wrapped in yellowed paper. It looked like it had sat there for years, and I was in shock. It's indescribable.
When he unwrapped the newspaper, Zion recognized the museum's priceless collection of Breguets.
It seemed so impossible. I couldn't believe my eyes. It was that incredible. I didn't remember the Marie Antoinette, but I knew I had a very important Breguet in front of me.
In shock and unable to sleep, Zion needed to speak with the curator of the museum, Rachel Hassan.
I got in my car at around 11 o'clock and drove like a madman. So I got there and say to her, Rachel, I think I saw the museum's collection.
At first, the curator would not believe the claim, but a meeting was arranged and she came face to face with the missing Marie Antoinette.
Zion says, when Rachel saw the clocks, she called to me. I fell to the floor in a swoon, and when I woke up, I started to cry. But for me, it was like finding a lost child. I can't explain it.
96 of the 106 watches were eventually returned to the museum. They'd been taken by a man called Naman Dila. And whilst Dila was a master thief, he was a terrible salesman. Wary of being caught, he left the burgled Breguets in safe deposit boxes where they sat abandoned for 23 years. Dila died of cancer in 2004, his crime undetected. On his deathbed, he confessed to his wife about the great watch heist. She hired a lawyer in Israel who started making calls to arrange the return of the stolen goods. And so, finally, after adventures in Paris and Jerusalem, after guillotines and dead queens, after cat burglars and wild goose chases, it's time.
I'm about to go and gaze on the face, or more correctly, I should say, the dial of the most famous watch in all the world.
The recovered watch is once again the shining centerpiece of the museum's watch collection. And it's now in a secure case, in a secure room, given that the estimated value of the watch is over $50 million. The museum have arranged for me and Marie Antoinette to finally meet one another, away from the visitors, in a secure back room used by their horologists. And for once, I'm speechless.
And so, here it is finally. Breguet's masterpiece. So, one has to put on the gloves for this. It is so precious. This is something you can say is truly unique.
oh, this is a special moment in my life, to actually hold the Marie Antoinette, the watch made by Breguet for the Queen. Through a rock crystal glass face, both back and front, the internal gold workings of the Marie Antoinette are there for all to see and become dazzled. All points of friction are in sapphire. The case itself is gold. There's a thermometer, a power indicator, a calendar, a tourbillon, everything Breguet knew in a single watch. It is truly a poem written in clockwork. And so this watch has survived for over 200 years. It survived a revolution. Survived being stolen, disappeared, out of sight to everybody, lost and unseen in a safety deposit box somewhere. And eventually coming to light and being returned to the museum. It's emotional to look at it, and I can understand that the curators here were so emotional when it came back that I believe they actually wept. The Queen had returned. And then, unexpectedly, the watch began to tick. Ah, that's the second hand there. Breguet's engineering genius meant that just a little momentum can power up the watch's perpetual mechanism. So after years of being static, I held it in my hand, and as if rewarding an elderly man after a long quest, the 200-year-old watch, for a few miraculous seconds, came back to life before being returned to the safety of its case. I've often wondered what life would have been like if I'd chosen to pursue a career in engineering rather than as an entertainer. But it's interesting that my great hobby of clocks is all about the subject of time. And I'm in a profession where the essence of success is all about timing. Graham, it's lovely to have you back. And so will you start off the show, very apt, clock watching.
The audience at just a minute.
But there's something satisfying that at this point in my long career in entertainment, I'm once again back with my love of clocks. You could say an old timer has finally met another one. Time well spent? About 75 years ago, a very long time ago, I first started taking interest in clocks, taking them apart, repairing them, mending them, recreating them. And it's interesting how times have changed, because then telling the time was a mechanical process. Then it became digital, and now it's even atomic. So something as beautiful as Breguet's watch here, the Queen, in one sense is obsolete. But it now just exists, really, as a beautiful machine, but with a heartbeat. So, what does Breguet's masterpiece tell us? That it's important in life to count every second, but also very important to make sure every second counts.
Marie Antoinette on display.
Just in time, I found you just in time. Before you came, my time was running low. And changed my lonely life, that lovely, lonely life, that lovely, lonely